Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts.
Phrenobulax.
Gusson.
Oh, I always wondered what that X in the upper left hand corner does.
The more you know.
Or however that stupid sound effect went. <Yeah. laughs>
Yeah, that's it. That's
we're showing her age.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Polycast, episode 86. I'm co-host the Mian Team, and joining me today are host Daniel Quick.
Is it 2010 or 2010? You decide.
Makalua.
I'm going to need more caffeine before I decide that, thanks.
QNL.
Hello.
And guest co-hosts Cossin.
Hey.
And Phrenobulax.
Hello from London.
The first dinosaur on Polycast.
Phrenobulax.
It sounds the name of a dinosaur. Not that you're old, yeah, but it sounds like the name of a dinosaur.
Dan's cold. He goes for the low blows on occasion. Don't worry, we'll keep him in line.
And it also happens to be his birthday today.
Oh, indeed.
Happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
We are sorry for taking out of your birthday time.
If not for Makalua's non-singing role, we would sing.
Yes.
Alas, she has forbidden.
It's in her contract.
Well, it's mostly Dan that I'm worried about singing now that Imran's gone.
Well, strictly speaking, since it's just the no-singing rule, happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Oh, no.
Oh, no rapping either.
A rap version.
Yes.
New rule, no rapping.
Actually, I think this is adding to Ian's birthday because he is a fan of the show, or at least he told me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Woo. It's a real surprise to be invited, but nice to be here.
Why you got invited? There are a number of ways to go about getting invited. Whining generally doesn't work, but that doesn't apply to you.
Please let me on. It's my birthday. In the research lab, we talked about leader oddities.
Sea tiles should be bigger than land tiles.
Stacks of doom turning into armies and other mechanisms for controlling them.
Then from the vault, forum talk, preferred beyond the sword era, and miscellaneous unit values.
Come on into the research lab, where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but may be in the future.
Thread started by Kill Me Please. Leader auditors, the idea of having negative traits for leaders. He's given some examples here. Xenophobic for Justinian, savage for Genghis Khan, Boudicca, extravagant for Montezuma, Catherine, paranoid for Stalin, etc., etc. The thing that it reminded me of was there's a game called Crusader Kings, which uses this sort of similar technique with the characters that you play, that you have both positive and negative characteristics that change over time. You can be proud or you can be valorous, and you know these have effects on things like monetary income and how well your armies behave. So I think it's an interesting idea. But the big difference is that in that game, you have offspring and they pick up some of your characteristics. And as they grow up, they change over time. But I guess with Civ, we have static characters who don't get old and don't sort of start religious dynasties or anything. But I think it's an interesting idea, particularly, say, Genghis Khan, the savage trait. Conquered cities would lose as many as half their population on being conquered, minus 20% culture. On the good side, enemies suffer increased war weariness. I think it's an interesting take on the idea of leader characteristics. Not just to have positive traits, but to also have negative traits.
Yeah, I agree. I wouldn't say that all the traits are necessarily negative, because there's bad and good to each trait that he gave. I mean, the words that he gave are a little bit negative.
Yeah.
But I actually really like this idea of having another aspect to each leader that you can manipulate.
Yeah, I like it too.
And if you could spread the bad and good split to the normal traits as well. Should be both a good side and a downside to the particular traits.
Sure. One thing is that if you had these traits from the beginning, people might get a little bit confused about it. just because there are so many traits. But at the same time, like, having another option for traits increases the number of leaders you can have, right?
True, yes.
I mean, because now there's three parameters instead of two.
That's true.
I find it a bit game-breaking at times, though, because you have some traits that would be affecting leaders early game, where it would be quite hurtful. For example, gentle with Gandhi would give plus one unhappy face with whipping. It's quite bad because you won't be whipping as much, and whipping is very good early game.
Except for that if you're not at war, you would actually be ahead as long as you didn't stack whipanger, which is interesting. I actually think a lot of these are good ideas. Now, obviously, you'd need to look at them in terms of balance. For example, paranoid would have a chance to really overwhelm people in espionage early and wind up getting really cheap conversions. Or, you know, maybe the extravagance a little bit too much on the good side and not enough on the bad side, because you can generally trade for a luxury resource and get extra happiness that way. But for the most part, I like these as ideas, and I think that this is something that could really add some dynamic aspect to gameplay that we haven't seen in a while.
Yeah, I think like QNL just said, the idea of having another set of parameters to differentiate the different leaders even further is a good thing, because some of the leaders can be a little bit samey if you're not too careful. I'm not sure if gentle is really an oddity for Gandhi. That's a slightly... or Mao being ignorant, I think might be some...
Some of the labels.
Especially because he's getting bonuses for having a state religion building.
Wow.
Yes.
But considering the way she usually plays out in game, fanatical is perfect for Isabella.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's true.
Some of them, too, like, they don't match up to their AI very well. Frederick getting a bonus to his drafting, that would just be miserable in the current AI's hands. The AI doesn't stay in nationhood practically ever. So for Frederick, he would just have negative 10 output without any benefits, whereas a human would be able to get a lot.
Another idea that I was thinking is that there's another game that uses similar things, which is this game called Victoria, where you have generals who have characteristics. So when you get a great leader in Civ 4, they could actually have some characteristics as well. So it's not just the leader of your country, but your general might also take on some characteristics. In Victoria, when you create a general, they may be a sound tactician, so they have a bonus in terms of attacking, but maybe they're lazy, so they don't attack very often, or they sit back. So there's, I quite like the idea of applying these characteristics, not just to the leader, but also to maybe some of the other in-game characters. It could be like a random function that these great people pick up certain characteristics. They have a bit more personality rather than just being a standard great merchant or a standard great prophet.
I think that's a great idea.
I like where you're going with that, because if you settle them in a city, then you can add the associated benefits to the city.
Yeah.
So now you have some incentive to spread out where you're settling them based on your specialization or what you're trying to do with your empire.
Really like that idea, even better than the original idea.
Can it also be maybe tied to events as well? I don't know if that's how it works in this games like Victoria and Crusader Kings. If your country's at war, then some of your leaders will pick up certain aggressive traits. You know, they'll pick these up as sort of experience, essentially.
Oh, now I know you've killed that suggestion for one person on the panel, relating that to random events. Good.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I didn't mention your name, Phil. Why do you think everything's about you?
From the Mian team, what do you want from me? I would like to see it where you have two or three differing fixed benefits available to each type of great person. Maybe not for all of them, maybe just two for some that are more rare or whatever. Or maybe you could do it where you'll get one kind of benefit if you settle versus another kind of benefit if you were to bulb, for example. Like the one-time benefit to your empire versus something over time. That would kind of balance the tendency for people to bulb great scientists or settle other specialists. Make it a strategic choice.
Yeah, call the trait scholarly. They'll give you a better academy if you were to build it.
Yeah.
That's a nice idea. I always seem to end up with lots of priests in my games, and I never know what to do with them. So if I have somebody who's a bit more fanatical or, I don't know, a traditionalist, it might be nice to use that trait rather than just settle them and get the kind of hammer bonus all the time.
I found myself mostly nitpicking with these in terms of, some of the names. The ignorant being one, and savage perhaps now, and I know...
Not PC,
One thing I would like to know is for the traditionalist trait, Kill Me Please is the one trait that he didn't suggest a leader that it could fall under. Just a couple of points. Number one, on the nihilist, one for Peter, which, yes, I admit I had to do a lookup of that word. I mean, it sounded like nil, so nothingness, so what exactly is that nothingness? Well, total rejection of established laws and institutions, and anarchy, terrorism, or any other revolutionary activity. The first and second definitions of this noun on dictionary.reference.com. So then I look at that, and then I think, under good, plus 10% to research, 2 times shorter anarchy period, except the name talks about anarchy, terrorism, or other revolutionary activity, so I'm not sure it would be shorter. Under the good category, just as it's named.
Maybe he's just so used to it that it transitions more rapidly, I don't know.
Maybe. I think that's a little in contradiction with itself there. But the only other, generally speaking, minor issue you could end up with is if you had this trait, and then, of course, random personalities is one of the options in the game. It wouldn't necessarily be that you have a gentle Gandhi. You can end up with a fanatical Gandhi or a militarist Gandhi or something like that. But still, that applies to any of the leader traits that we currently have already. Just with the game balance issue, I think that's pretty minor, though. Who could be a traditionalist?
Tokugawa.
Ah, Tokugawa. Oh, yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess it would work for him. I was just trying to think. He doesn't open borders a whole lot, but you might see some fighting there anyway, so it's a little awkward to give him extra culture, but yeah, whatever. It makes sense. I actually agree with that suggestion.
I like the idea of having a third parameter, even if I don't agree with all of his classifications or names.
Actually, some of these suggested both bad and good are ones that I hadn't even thought of before, like under arrogant for Pericles, good, plus 1 happiness per vassal.
You actually already get 1 happiness in all your cities per vassal that you own, so this would actually bring it to 2.
That's true, yeah.
The plus 25% to culture and plot flipping is interesting. I wonder just how much more rapidly that would allow one to flip somebody. Because Pericles is a bit of a culture monger in general. Creative, so he can already press in the Greek unique building.
Yeah.
He gets a bonus towards it.
Yeah, that's sort of overdoing it, I think.
So God help you if you get Sistine Chapel or something. That would be hilarious.
City tiles should be bigger than land tiles, by Gungor. His opinion is that moving ships around the ocean is a drag and a lot of micro, so he would make ocean tiles bigger. For example, 1 city tile would be about the same size as 4 land tiles to reduce the time to move around. It would make odd shapes for coastal tiles, of course, but overall I think this is a bad idea, because ships already get improved movements, and late game 6 movements units would make warfare very, very powerful, because you could strike a city on the top of the continent and then move in 1/3 to the bottom of the continent and strike another city.
I actually really didn't think that this idea was good, and I like that Ernest's other posters put in, which is that just increase the movement of ship, whether it be just increase the movement of galleons in general, or simply increase the movement that they have over ocean per se.
I also like the counter-suggestion of increasing naval movement, but then having some penalties depending on where you are. Specifically, you could double all ship movement, but then force coast and enemy culture to cost 2 movement points instead of 1 then. That would allow you to transition in the water, but you wouldn't just be able to like blitz across enemy territory, capturing cities like every second, because you'd still have the same movement rate if you're trying to fight through their culture. Or you could go around, but then you probably wouldn't save any turns at all, because you'd have to exit and then go back in. I think that you could keep the complete naval strike from becoming way overpowering, and still allow a little bit more flexibility in terms of where people go with their ships.
Yeah, one big problem I had with this was maybe you'll have a map with lots of little islands on it, and then what happens? Big sea tiles with smaller coast tiles, and he's like, yeah, it would be hard mathematically, but I just don't see how it would be possible. I don't favor like putting wind as a factor, because no other factors are really in Civ, with the exception of random events, which Phil and I both hate. So I think it's just better to increase movement over ocean tiles. Maybe have them cost 1/2 movement point instead of 1.
I think this is a topic that came up in a previous podcast to do with having trade currents, and was it?
Yes.
Trade winds and that sort of thing. There's one reply later on by Elka Bian, I think it is, who talks about how Columbus didn't find the new continent in a week. You know, he didn't zip across the ocean. He was dependent on currents and tides. So why not, instead of having fewer tiles, just have some tiles that are like quicker because they're part of a trade current? And there might be a way that you have the sort of North Atlantic drift that means that ships traveling back to Europe can move a lot quicker. I prefer something like that, where there are things like currents and prevailing winds that would affect the movement penalty of a tile, rather than having bigger tiles.
That's...
As long as the map generator could handle it and we wouldn't get complete nonsense like lake trade currents or knows what.
Yeah, an inland sea that goes at 1,000 miles an hour.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's a great idea. Not necessarily like individual waves or anything like that, but just in terms of currents. For example, Pacific, there's a current that goes clockwise from the equator up to the Arctic coast, you know, that kind of thing.
Hmm.
And yeah, the Mid-Atlantic as well.
As with anything we're introducing in Civ, so long as it can be that the AI can take, if not advantage, at least not have it be a disadvantage to them because you don't know what the heck they're doing. I know in another thread I've got it noted that in CFC users' bush face signature that AI sometimes stands for absolute idiot. But going back to the initial suggestion, I'm kind of half with everyone and half against everyone. I'm half with everyone that, yes, this idea of making one sea tile equal four land tiles, just increase the movement of ships. But at the same time, we're talking about a solution to a problem that Gangor identifies, and I really don't think that we have an issue here. I don't think we need to do either one of those things, as a matter of fact. I think a lot of the issues that I had with naval battles was the AI's inability to do much of anything with it, even to the point of, if not completely ignoring it, or in some cases implementing it and doing absolutely silly things, like building X number of galleons or caravels and then just having them sit in their cities waiting to be destroyed. Beyond the Sword addressed a lot of those points, so I really think that this is a non-issue. If you're going to do it, then yes, increase the ship movement. But I'd just be perfectly fine being left alone and going on to something else.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a non-issue, but I do like the idea of trade winds and sort of prevailing currents, but that's not really what he's talking about here.
Yeah, that extension of the conversation that we, as you had mentioned before, that we talked about in an earlier episode, absolutely. Yeah. But strictly speaking, what he's talking about here, oh.
No way. I like exploring big expanses of nothingness. That's part of the fun of the game, I think.
If I had to manually move my frickin' units every turn to do that, then okay, that might be an issue, but then that's when we get into the just auto-explore issue, which we've had for some time, which addresses that.
Dull the ship and press E.
Yeah, I do like to manually control it at times, because sometimes it's automated path. I don't know what they've been drinking, driving the units, but...
Well, hey, when you're on the high seas, I mean...
I guess they're taking some of that contaminated water.
Well, there is one response at the end of the thread from Ed Case talking about the riskiness of seafaring. And one thing I seem to remember from Civ 3 was the fact that galleys could actually get across ocean tiles, but it was a sort of random variable. Sometimes they made it, sometimes they sank. And I kind of miss that in the fact that seafaring is fairly straightforward and you don't have that sort of riskiness of ships sinking, particularly early in the game. You've only got fairly rudimentary boats and galleys and things.
Isolated starts to be a completely different world if galleys could gamble on ocean.
Well, I think that'd be quite a nice thing. I mean,
I do too, but it would definitely be a very different game.
Yeah, true.
I remember that from Civ 3, and I actually kind of missed that feature of maybe you could get a galley to strike out over the ocean, and maybe you'd make it. But, you know, with the probability on each tile, the chance that you would fail would increase, which was a lot like ancient seafaring. This topic is talking about Stack of Dooms generally trying to reduce their power and add more sophistication in the way it's actually played in the game. He basically adds another sort of aspect of gameplay to the game, which is that the units in the stack will act as one unit, as an army, as an actual army, rather than just a bunch of individual units. And he actually adds some other aspects of gameplay in terms of giving food to the army and things like that. Now, I don't know if he actually really talks about this feature in a gameplay sense. He's just talking about it in a text sense.
Yeah, he doesn't give any definitive value suggestions, just kind of in general terms for gameplay.
I generally like the idea of adding more sophistication to warmongering, and I do like some of the ideas that he has here, having Stack act as an actual army, because humans just tend to make Stacks when they play the game, and we've been doing that since Civ 3. Maybe just taking that aspect of gameplay that people already use and turning that into an army is a pretty good idea. Otherwise, I think some of the aspects that he's talking about on their implications is accounted for in increased maintenance for troops out of borders and things like that.
I don't mind the proposal for an army. For example, if this concept of making sets of units stronger but with diminishing returns were applied properly, it really would encourage some stack splitting that doesn't go on currently. That could be beneficial. I do not like the idea of having a food supply or supply chain on military units in general in this game. It doesn't fit the scale of any of the basic civilization games, and it has the potential to become extremely incessant, especially if you're fielding multiple armies. And a lot of times you don't want to pillage, but even if that were required to have a stronger unit, it just tends to be annoying. Supply chain things like that are, in my opinion, for another game. But the concept of armies was a good one, and Civ 3 explored it to an extent, and I would like to see that brought back, similar to the galley thing we discussed earlier.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to bring back the army thing, because that is something I do miss from Civ 3. But like you say, this issue of supply, I mean, that's another game. I mean, that's just far too much micromanagement, and I think it would just spoil the ability to wage war in a kind of effective way without having to worry all the time about feeding your army. I think, you know, you pay maintenance costs for your units, so that kind of is taken as read that you're supplying them.
One of the difficulties in coming up with topics to discuss on this show is to see whether or not it's been discussed in the past. As it so happens, we did talk about supply lines back in the second pilot, and I felt that, well, considering that was the second pilot and that was some time ago, it was fair in terms of having that brought up here because it's in relation to other concepts. But to reiterate what I'm sure I was saying way back then, the supply, food, and whatnot, as the 80s boy points out, to a degree this is already modeled with the healing mechanic. The fact that it takes much longer to heal an enemy territory can be seen in some ways as an analog for having access to a supply chain. Although I understand the importance of supply in war as well as in war simulations, I'm unconvinced that Civ, and specifically your Civ 4 not being a war simulation, requires that degree of detail. Now he does also say, but I'm open to being convinced, but I am not. You will not convince me of that. And some people reference Rise of Nations, actually, which Civ in real time actually having a physical unit that was a supply unit, and I found that most annoying for reasons that have already been identified.
The interesting thing about armies is that in other games, I'm thinking of this one called Hearts of Iron, the latest version, where it's quite a sophisticated way of modelling divisions and reinforcements of armies. And I think this issue of rotating your troops so that as one suffers attrition, they, you know, they move to the back and another unit steps up. If that can be sort of modelled within an army group, I think that might be quite interesting. You give your troops more of a chance to retreat and to be replaced by reserves. That might be an interesting thing to try to equate with an army. Thinking back to Civ 3, whenever I had armies running around on the continent, the AI would just sort of run in the other direction, and the AI just didn't know how to deal with armies, either building them or actually facing up to them. It wasn't impossible to defeat armies, but I think the AI would need quite a bit of coaching in order to make good use of it.
When it comes to armies, we have talked about armies in some sense in the past. In episode 58, we looked at how much of an occupation army is sufficient. And last season, in episode 69, emphasis added for certain reasons.
Carrying on Imran's memory.
There you go. We talked about a proposal for a professional army and black market in the Civ series. But now we're talking about more of a formal army organization as recognized in-game. As has already been discussed, when we have a particular stack, I actually think of in my stack, when I think of my army, I think of if I've got 10 swordsmen and, say, 5 axemen, I think of here is my swordsman army of 10 and my axemen army of 5 individual units. And I will often use them as an army, and we have the ability, as we know, to select units of a particular type so you can move them as an army. But this is more of a formal recognition of that, where if it was to become an army, and to tie this into Civilization Revolution, which nobody mentioned in the thread, but part of me is kind of not surprised, In Civilization Revolution, most battles are fought on the army level. When you have three units of the same type in the square, you can form an army which has the combined strength of the three units. You don't have to. It's not automatic. It's a conscious choice that you make. Then when that unit achieves three victories, it becomes a veteran unit, and then three more wins will get you to an elite unit. And the issue there, of course, is, yes, you have the combined strength, but the downfall is that if the army loses, then you lose all three of those units. Whereas, of course, if you had them as three individual units, if one died, then it would just be one unit. But you weren't able to take advantage of the increased strength, which is a fair bit, which, if I'm recalling correctly, in Civ Rev, it's like a 50% boost. And we know that Civ Rev is all about incredible bonuses, so I don't think that that kind of scale in terms of percentage is appropriate for a Civ 4 or a Civ 5. But that idea in general, I like, and I think that that can have place in Civ 4, or certainly in Civ 5, which is kind of what Gengor is getting at here when it comes to the army argument itself. Now, this part about the army carries a supply of food, and each unit consumes an amount of food per turn, which is getting a bit into the complicated field, which he actually noted in his conclusion. Quote, with the addition of two relatively simple concepts, the complexity of Civ is much increased and, in my opinion, improved. Unquote. It has definitely increased the complexity, but I don't think it's improved on this point about the supply of food. Some of the idea, like, you can replenish it by pillaging a farm or a pasture, that's kind of an interesting element in terms of that suggestion, but I don't like that suggestion in and of itself. Which is all goes back to the supply line.
Yeah, I think one of the posters down the list, was it Rizemeal, says he sees the whole solution as being overly complex, and he says it's like reinventing a perfectly serviceable wheel. Every unit costs its home city food and shields. That mechanism already exists when you're actually creating the units, so you'd have to reinvent a lot of the other infrastructure within the game in order to implement this. And I think it's more for a kind of a strictly sort of military game, this sort of thing of supply. Things like Hearts of Iron represents supply quite effectively, but it sort of happens behind the scene. You don't have units running around supplying. That would just be impossible to manage. And also, I mean, there are a couple of other points I'm not so sure about. He talks about, you know, pooling these units together into an army. Hit points are pooled together, but then how do you deal with things like if you're being attacked by trebuchets or catapults? Some units, if they've got the drill promotion, will not be getting collateral damage. How do you deal with that? I mean, it seems that would be quite complex mathematically.
Yeah, and in Civilization Revolution, I couldn't mix and match your swordsmen, say, and your axemen, not that there are swordsmen and axemen in Civilization Revolution, but taking that idea, you couldn't have swordsmen and an axeman be in an army of itself. You would have to have a swordsman army and an axeman army formally, that they would all be combined. So in that way, you reduce some of that mathematical difficulty that you're getting into. You could still treat your stack as an army. So you could say that my army are my swordsmen and my axemen, and they're on that particular tile and they move together. But really, with the formal army, it kind of ends up being initially one less click or two, where you don't have to select all the units of the same type. But then there would also be the benefit of pooling together all of their promotion. Now, I'm not sure, like in Civilization Revolution, if you had three swordsmen and one of them had City Raider, then if you form them into an army, now all three of those are considered to have City Raider, and you have the additional bonus of it being an army. I'm not certain we'd want to necessarily go to that extreme, but I guess you kind of would have to if you're then treating all of them as one unit. Either that, you either apply them to the whole army, or it just loses it because, oh well, two of the three don't have it, so sad, too bad. But that's a nuanced thing we're getting into now. Why perhaps some of us are liking the idea of an army like myself, but not so much the supply line. I believe it was Kamikaze who said this. Strategy would refer to the more overarching direction of gameplay that a player decides upon, whilst tactics refer to the minutiae manipulated in order to obtain a better result. And I think when you're getting into, is it a supply unit? Is it spending time on a turn? Is it pillaging this? How much food per turn, diminishing returns, if you're only able to supply them half, and so on and so forth. I think that that's just adding another labor to try to figure out what the hell am I supposed to do. That really is like a war simulation sort of consideration.
I mean, the only other thing you could do with the supply issue is just to make it a unit promotion, so that baseline is that if you go into a foreign land to wage war, your units will suffer attrition automatically unless they have a unit with them that has the supply promotion. Just sort of take care of it that way. If you're spending several turns on foreign lands, some of your units will actually suffer damage because they can't get supplies unless there's a unit in the same square. You know, rather like the medic promotion, you have something that sort of takes care. In a sense, that's what armies do. They have parts of the units that look after the supply. Why not just have a unit in your stack that has that promotion? And so that unit group that you're moving around, that stack of doom, is sort of taken care of in terms of its supply. Maybe that might just seem a little unnecessary, having to go into that amount of detail. I don't know.
You could have that rolled into the medic promotion in some way.
Yeah.
Tie that into what I was saying earlier with 80s Boy. To a degree, supply food and whatnot is already modeled with the healing mechanic. Without a medic promotion on a particular unit, you can be healing inside enemy territory, but of course we know that takes forever as compared to, say, outside of enemy territory. And of course you get a little bit better still if it happens to be inside one of your cities. Perhaps having that healing mechanic, having that medic promotion, as if there wasn't enough reason to have a medic with your stack already, have it so that it's able to either implicitly heal a little faster. When I think of healing faster, I think of patching you up, sewing you up, that kind of thing, resetting bones, whatever that happens to be. That could then also be considered that if you have that promotion, then you are able to feed people a little more quickly, which means they heal themselves a little more quickly. I realize then you get into the minutiae itself of what does that translate into actual turns of how much to get back to full strength or whatever, but I think that that could be included in there. Or we could just say, again, back to 80s Boy, we consider that already part of the healing mechanic, and we don't need to address that any more specifically than that.
I think probably the latter. I think it is already implied. Also as well, that when you have units based overseas or fighting in enemy territory, don't you have a financial penalty for that, don't you?
Yeah.
Isn't that, in a sense, the cost of supply?
That falls into the strategy that Kamikaze was talking, the overall direction. Do I go to war now? Yes, no. Do I go to war with this person? Do I split my stack up? So on and so forth. Do they all go in at once, or does the first wave go in because that's going to be sufficient, and then I can move in the second wave and not have to worry about having to pay so much military maintenance as I was before?
Yeah.
This is a Vault segment with topics cut from earlier episodes, but I found relevance again later. From episode 83 with Dan Q, The Mean Team, Kamikaze, Heraclitus, MMC, Peach Rocks, and Q&L. Favorite era beyond the start?
I really don't understand why medieval gets so few votes. I mean, it's a very interesting part of the game. It's actually when you're sort of established and can actually wage a real war instead of just skirmishes like in the classical era.
Because on high levels, you can't war in the medieval era unless you're playing a slow speed. That's why a lot of people don't like it.
I usually play on epic or marathon.
Or at least it's still very frequently practical.
Well, okay, but I actually often war in the medieval era. I don't play on really high difficulties, though, so I don't know.
It's the high difficulties that screw it up, because if you're playing, like, say, Immortal Normal, and you go up to an AI, it will probably have castles between 500 and 1,000 AD already, and it can get, like, a longbow a turn while you're sitting there bombarding that castle. How many units in the city do you want to deal with for every single city you attack? It's really obnoxious.
Okay, that is true.
Which goes back to the siege, where you want to be able to stop them getting the longbow.
Well, yeah, but you can't bombard the castle very well. If you don't have accuracy on a catapult, it takes away 2% defense against that, and if you do, it takes away 4%.
But what about certain unique units? What's the Byzantine replacement for the knight? That's a pretty powerful unit, if I remember right.
Yeah, the cataphract. It's a 12-strength knight replacement. But it doesn't ignore castles. And a longbow in a castle is already stronger than it, because cataphracts don't ignore first strikes. So without any promotions at all, a longbow will beat it on average.
So does that mean that civilizations with unique units in the medieval era are basically... offensive units in the medieval era are basically screwed?
It's hard to make use of them on high levels, is what I'm saying.
Oh, actually, what about the Korean civ? Don't they have an improved catapult?
Yeah, it gets a 50% bonus against melee.
The only medieval unit I find any use is the Lanzknecht.
Ooh, I like that unit.
I'm sorry, if anyone rates it even average, they're overrating it.
Mm.
It does beat maces and mounted, but offensively it doesn't do anything special for you.
It's not great, but it's still not bad.
Well, if medieval sucks due to general consensus, then, well, I think Renaissance is probably the best time to play. You have well-established religious blocks, you get to explore the new world. I probably would consider that my second favorite period.
Well, maybe given what happens on the higher difficulty levels, which I haven't experienced myself because I'm at Prince at the moment, if we said what our favorite era was and then also indicated what difficulty level we played at, then we can put that into context. I would also vote medieval and I'm at Prince.
I think I play on Monarch or something like that.
I actually go anything but medieval. I hate it.
You can be serious. The ancient era is so streamlined. It's basically always the same for me.
Well, that's some of the reasons why people like it.
For me, it's not.
It's so dull.
Sometimes it's a choice of whether a rush is good call.
You enter classical so quickly. It's hard to...
Yeah, well, there's that too. I put classical and ancient together. They're effectively the same thing.
They're not. Classical era is interesting.
They're not, but...
You can't use horse archers or swords without being in classical.
Yeah, maybe, but still. Strategy you have in ancient period would carry on to classical to a point. A
little bit.
Yeah, but in classical you at least have some choices, while in ancient, basically, you build a city, build a second city.
The thing is that you should be making those choices in the ancient period.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Which influences what you do, which is why I think it's different.
That is true.
I get your point.
But the modern era is dull. It's basically just a wrap-up. How can you like that part?
Not always. That's not true.
My favorite is industrial, and I play at Monarch just because I feel like most of the texts that I have to get, I've gotten liberalism by then, so I've gotten most of the civic options that I finally get to create some units, have some real firepower. Unless peaceful win, I don't have to worry that much about tech after that.
As an immortal player on Pangaea, I would favor industrial as well.
Yeah.
Because infantry and artillery are just so ridiculous against everything for such a long period of time.
Yeah.
And if it's not Pangaea, I would probably take modern. Because I really like those naval sweeps with marines plus anything that can kill or damage units, either fighters or nukes.
Mm.
And just burning every single coastal city I can get near.
I find the game doesn't get that far long enough.
I actually dislike the fact that nukes and modern weapons aren't used enough.
Well, what can you do about that, huh? It's the end of the game.
I don't know that I couldn't launch more than 180 nukes in my Let's Play, and I apologize for that. So I couldn't break 200, but maybe next time.
It's all right.
Global warming permitting.
By the time I reach the modern era, there really isn't any challenge, any nation that would bring, let's say, sort of a rival superpower with which I could actually engage in a huge war. That's maybe the reason why I'm underwhelmed by the tactical choices available.
Well, you can hit nukes in the 1600s, and if you're playing like a mortal, that might be really helpful to be able to do. But I usually don't get them until the 1700s, because I tend to tech a little slowly relative to the average player at my level. But even there, they can be pretty strong.
I prefer the modern era simply because, well, who doesn't like nukes?
Me. I refuse to use them.
Nukes and tanks.
Nope. No nukes.
Unless you're on the receiving end.
Yeah. Nobody likes getting nukes.
Kamikaze, what's your favorite era?
Yeah, definitely industrial. You get that big production boost right at the end. That can be game-breaking if you haven't already broken the game.
Yeah.
That's a really easy path to go for space race victory.
And it's really fun. When corporations come into play, if you want, you can just sit there and build up your nation. I really like leading a sort of mini-industrial revolution.
Definitely.
Just love watching how the production goes up.
Yeah!
From episode 71 with Dan Q, Makalua, Peach Rocks, the DS, and the Mian team.
When we did the Ask Sid way back, like episode 50 or something, mine was the last question that got asked. It was, and I thought it was a good one, what has no one ever asked you but you wish they would?
Ooh.
Yeah, he went on about why do we choose the values for the units we choose? You know, why is this guy a strength 4 and not a strength 5? Now, Not to call Sid a weirdo or anything, but that seemed kind of like an obvious question to me. I mean, or the answer was obvious. Like, if you, all you gotta do is look at the game and you'll see that those values are obvious. Yeah, sure, you could multiply everything by 50, but that would just make it more complicated.
To a point, I mean, take War Elephants and Praetorians. I think both of those units are insanely overpowered. Why are those units 8 power? Then they should be a bit less.
We'll also get into interesting things like, historically, muskets were cheaper than long training involved and all that. They made it stronger for the game balance or whatever, but they could just as easily have been 10 strength rather than 9. And the gameplay implications may or may not change from that. I think it's a good question in terms of the disparity between certain units of certain eras could easily have been changed a little bit, and you still hold up the gameplay to an extent. So it is kind of curious why he picked the exact values, or whoever did the balancing picked the exact values.
Yeah, for a few units, particularly in Civ 4, it's a bit curious, like Longbowmen, Elephants, and Praetorians. I mean, they would be my three. Like, why did you do that?
Elephants are obscene.
They're wonderful.
I can't believe they didn't nerf elephants in 3.19. And Praetorians are just way overdue. Romophiles, I guess.
They have no counter. If you have elephants and axes standing together, nothing beats them until muskets. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know that. You guys saw that last Sunday. I basically had elephants and cleaned up two AIs pretty very easily. The game was over because basically I cleaned up the two AIs that were stuck on my continent.
I'll bet catapults beat them.
Well, I was about to say, yeah, if you've got sufficient number of cats to defend yourself against them. But other than that, as you said, with that combination, wow.
You know, obviously, whoever has the elephants is also going to have catapults. They already have the technologies, obviously.
Yep.
It's just a pain to deal with the elephants. And one of the hard counters to catapults is horse archers. And elephants just destroy horse archers. I love horse archers, by the way, so when I see elephants, they can
fly
my horse archer charges.
Sad face.
Yeah, I mean, it's even more if you compare to the pikeman versus elephant, it's like, pikeman, hi, I'm a useless unit. I'm available much later, and I can fortify. Ooh.
You might want them if you're going the cannon line, because the AI might get curators pretty quickly. And if you have pikes, you can at least hold up to them, and if you're on defensive terrain, it'll prevent the curators from wanting to attack you.
Carassas just, I don't know. But elephants get 2 promotions, pikes only get 1. I don't think the Carassa argument, I think Carassas are much of a worry.
I don't know. I've had situations where, especially AIs that really favor the mounted line in general, will suddenly turn, like, 20 of their knights into curators. And if you don't have something in your cannon stack to protect your cannon, you are screwed. Because they deal flanking damage to cannons. So that's a problem. For the bigger AI stacks, you want something to deal with them, or at least to keep them off you until you initiate the siege collateral damage on them. And, grenadiers can do it, but why not use pikes? They're a lot less expensive.
Difficult to know. I mean, it depends on where, if you're attacking your city and worried about the Carassa defend, the Carassa countercharge, pike is not going to be that much better off than the elephant. The elephant gets, as I said, gets the 2 promotions and does better against other stuff. The pike is only good against the horses. But I suppose it's about values of units, which is a question that Sid wanted asked. But as I said, the Carassas and pikes, I think, are quite okay in terms of the balance in their unit numbers, but War Elephants, Praetorians, and Longbows, that just, they make me want to cry. It's like, no, go away.
Not sure I agree with you on the Longbows. The other 2 sense.
Well, what?
Well, the Longbows are strictly garrison. They're kind of sad at anything else. You catch them in the open field, you can kill them with a horse archer, or even like a sword if it's got cover.
Oh yeah, but even so, I think they come up a bit too early.
Yeah, possibly. I think part of the problem is just that AI loves feudalism so much.
I mean, if you look at all the other eras and look at the defensive unit in comparison to the attacking unit, the longbow has a distinct advantage over what's around it, unless you count elephants, which I don't. It's one of my rules not to build them unless I have to.
I hardly ever get ivory, so I hardly ever get to build elephants.
Well, if I build elephants, it's like playing on a lower difficulty level, because really, it's just, if I get them, I abuse them so bad.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301 637 Poly.
In Europe, 44121288-7659. That's 44121288-Poly.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Record date?
January 16th, 2010.
Civilization 4, Warlords and Beyond the Sword sound clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright 2009, Civilized Communication at civcom.net.